In this last lecture, I want to talk about conjecture of Feyerstadt made in 1969 that I call his contact conjecture. This is related to the methods of proof, at least, are related to an earlier conjecture that he made that I mentioned in my last lecture. And repeat here in this first slide, this appears in his book in 1953, that if you take 13, or you fix one ball of radius 1, and then you arrange 13 further balls of radius 1 around it in such a way that they don't overlap, the question is how small can you make the sum of the distances to the origin? And the conjecture, so here, so I've got a different normalization than I usually use. I've got diameter 1 instead of radius 1, so everything's different from by a factor of 2 from what I wrote on Wednesday. But with diameter 1, the conjecture for 13 spheres is that you get at least 12 plus 7 over root 27, or 13.347 approximately. And this conjecture is still open. This is a function L that I introduced in my last lecture. It's just a piecewise linear function that's decreasing. It starts at value 1 at 1 and drops down to 0 at h0, which I've picked to be 1.26. And a slight modification of the conjecture from the previous slide is a theorem that I've proved, and that is that if we take n spheres and sum up their distance to the origin, we always get at most 12. If we could increase this constant from 1.26 to 1.3, then we would get that earlier conjecture. I mentioned in the last lecture that as a corollary, we get several other results, including a new proof of the Kepler conjecture on sphere packings of congruent balls in R3. But another implication is the one that I want to describe today, and that is his contact conjecture from 1969. If we take in 3-space a packing of equal balls such that each ball touches exactly 12 others, the conclusion is that the packing must consist of hexagonal layers. The corresponding problem in the plane is trivial because if I take a coin and surround it by 6, there's a unique way to surround it by 6, and then that same pattern gets extended throughout the plane to form the hexagonal packing. It's more difficult in 3 dimensions because the kissing arrangements that we get with 12 spheres, well, there are uncountably many different possible ways to arrange 12 so that they touch one in the center. And there are only 2 configurations that can lead to layers of hexagonal layers. And so out of those uncountably many possibilities, somehow the fact that we're extending it from a single, surrounding a single sphere with 12 to the requirement that they be able to fill space rigidifies things in such a way that locally you just get these 2 different patterns. So that's that was the claim of the conjecture and the theorem that I want to describe. And then the final corollary of this L12 inequality is the one that I discussed on Wednesday, of the strong dodecahedral conjecture. And then the relation between the different conjectures, the L12 inequality, which was the sum, this assertion, the sum of the distances over 12, 2, so it's at most 12, This is what I call L12. That implies all of the others. And today, I'll describe the second point, how L12 implies the full contact conjecture. And then I'll also go into details about the proof of L12. The what? No, because Feistel's original conjecture just deals with 13 spheres, and this is so it implies the 13 sphere case. So I want to view this inequality L12 as a graph classification problem. And so I'm going to take any packing in the annulus. So I'm taking a closed annulus with inner radius 2, outer radius 2 times its constant H0. I'm going back to my usual normalization now of spheres having radius 1. And this inequality, since this function is never bigger than 1, the inequality is trivial when V has cardinality at most 12. And so to look for a counterexample, I can assume without loss of generality that I always have a set of at least 13 spheres. And I want to turn this into a graph and consider a graph classification problem. And since I'm using H0 as a cutoff already, I'm just going to use the same cutoff. So any edge between two, anytime I have two centers of spheres whose distance is at most 2H0, then I'll connect those by an edge. And so then we want to understand all possible graphs that we get by taking at least 12 vertices and these edges. And the claim is the classification of graphs is then stating that there are no graphs that satisfy this inequality. And okay, so that's our first graph classification problem. The relation to the contact problem, this was understood by Feistel. It's a fairly simple relationship. It's found in this following lemma. Let V be any packing in R3, and we'll assume that every ball touches 12 others. Then, for any two centers of balls, either the distance is exactly equal to 2, or it's at least 2 times H0. And that's fairly simple. I just look at the... So we're assuming that each ball touches 12 others. So I'm going to let U be the center of a packing in R3, and I'm going to call U1 up through U12 the 12 that actually touch this one. So everyone touches 12 others. These are what I'm calling them. And then let's assume that we have a 13th that's not equal to any of the 12 and not equal to the one sphere that we fixed. By our inequality L12, if I take L evaluated on this distance divided by 2 and add 12, considering U as the one at the center, well, these numbers are all exactly equal to 1 because I've normalized things so that when the distance is 2, 2 divided by 1 is 1, L of 1 is equal to 1, and I just get 12 terms that equal 1 and a 13th term that equals something else, and my L12 inequality says that the sum of all of the L's is always at most 12. This equals 12, and so this term has to be at most 0. Well, I look at my function, and it hits 0 right here at 1.26, and since I'm doubling everything, that means that the distance has to be at least 2 times 8.0. So it's just a trivial consequence of this L12 inequality that in this entire packing, there are no distances whatsoever in this gap between 2 and 2 times H0. So what we're looking for then are packings with this that have this gap property. And in particular, if I look at the 12 spheres that surround one in the center, none of those distances between sphere centers will have distance between 2 and 2H0. So this motivates a definition or a class of packings that I want to look at. I'll take S2 to the sphere of radius 2 centered at the origin, and then I'll let this script V be the set of all packings in R3 that have cardinality exactly 12. They sit in the center, sit inside this sphere of radius 2, and they have this gap property that there are no distances between 2 and 2.52, twice this constant, 1.26. For each of these sets of vertices, again, I want to make this into a graph classification problem. And in this case, I'm going to use the contact graph. Since I don't have any distances between 2 and 2.50, it really doesn't matter whether I make it the contact graph or the same condition that I made before on the graph of going out to 2.52. Yes? So I'm defining this class script V. I'm calling it V. Okay, so with that, the Feyerstadt's contact conjecture follows from our two classification problems. The first is classification that comes up with this function L and this inequality. And the second is the contact graphs. And this classification problem has two solutions, the two that we want. So here I've shown one of the contact graphs, the cube octahedron, dual to the rhombic dodecahedron. So the unshaded edges form a rhombic dodecahedron, which is the Voronoi cell in the face-centered cubic packing. And I take the centers of each of the faces, and I get 12 vertices. And there are two pieces that get used. One is, this is what comes up in the face-centered cubic. And then if I take a hexagon going around the center of this polyhedron, I can just imagine rotating everything by 60 degrees, so that these triangles then line up and the squares line up. And that's the other arrangement of 12. And this one doesn't have a preferred plane of symmetry, but when I rotate by 60 degrees, there's a preferred plane of symmetry in the hexagonal close packing arrangement. And so because of that preferred plane, you see that the only way to arrange those pieces together is just by extending it to an entire plane of the same arrangement. And then once you've fixed one layer, the other layers are forced to go one upon another above that. And so if the classification just gives this hexagonal close packing arrangement in the face-centered cubic, you get Feyerstadt's conjecture as a corollary, because it's the only way you can fit the pieces together. So as soon as you have one hexagonal close packing piece, you get a whole plane, and then the planes are forced after that. And if you don't have any hexagonal close packing pieces, then you only have the other kind of piece, which is the face-centered cubic, and that then gives the face-centered cubic lattice when you tile with that, or repeat that one pattern. Okay, so in summary, we have two graph classification problems, one for L12 and one for contact graphs of 12 vertices. The first one involves 12 or more vertices, and the second classification problem has exactly 12 vertices. So we have two different problems to solve here, but the general structure of the proof is the same in both cases. And I'll organize the talk as much as possible so I don't have to repeat myself twice in everything that I say. The first thing I do, might be better if I go to the next slide and show you a picture. Instead of talking about planar graphs, I do everything in terms of hypermaps. So a hypermap is defined to be a finite set, which I'll call D. The elements of the hypermap are called darts, and a hypermap is a finite set D of darts together with three permutations that compose to the identity. So that's all it is. And given a planar graph, there's a simple way to construct a hypermap. So in this picture, these little triangles are the darts of the hypermap. I've drawn just a random planar graph here, which is this pentagon with edges sticking out. And then there's what you do is you create one dart for every angle inside the planar graph. And the first permutation F is for face permutation. I just go counterclockwise around each face. In this case, I have two faces, so I have two cycles for the permutation. And N stands for node. That gives the second permutation. And what I do for the second permutation, I've drawn my arrows backwards here. They should be counterclockwise going around each vertex in the planar graph. That gives the second permutation. And then the condition that the product of the three is equal to the identity forces the third permutation. This E is for edge. If you trace out what the composite does, it sends each dart to something at the opposite end of each edge. And so it has a geometric interpretation as well. That's the first point, is that everything gets represented combinatorially as hypermaps. Second main feature of the proof is that we have a computer program that what this program does is it classifies hypermaps that you give it a list of properties that you want the hypermap to satisfy, and it generates all hypermaps up to isomorphism that has those properties. And then in general, this program is giving you extraneous cases that you want to subsequently get rid of. And the next stage of the proof is linear programming, where you use linear programs to study the geometric realizability of each of the cases. And you use that to eliminate everything except for the cases that you want to one in the end. And in our case, there are none in the first case, and then just two possibilities in the second case. And as part of the linear programming, you get certain inequalities that come up that get thrown into the linear programming. There's another computer program that automatically proves nonlinear inequalities. And so you then invoke that program on each of the linear programs that come up in classification. So that's the general structure of both proofs. Let me say a few words about why hypermaps get used. First of all, they're just convenient from a computational point of view because it's a purely combinatorial notion, no geometries involved. Like, you know, when you talk about planar graphs, you have to say what planarity is. And, of course, you can do that in purely combinatorial ways, but Doing so with hypermaps is even more convenient. All the basic notions, I won't go into details, but all the basic notions of graphs and planar graphs can be translated over into hypermaps. So for instance, planarity is just given by a condition. It's basically that the Euler characteristic property holds for the hypermap, which can be expressed purely combinatorially. I started using these several years ago because of Gontier's formalization of the four-color theorem. He found that this was a convenient data structure for in formal proofs. So the steps to the proof that I outlined are the same as the basic outline of the proof of the Kepler conjecture from 1998. Some of you are familiar with that proof, and some of you might not be quite so familiar with it. I'll try to give my talk today in such a way that I'm emphasizing the things that have changed in the way I'm doing things now versus the way I used to do things back in the late 1990s. One thing that has changed, and that is this hypermap generation program. I have this formalization project where I'm trying to prove, do everything by computer formally all the way back to the fundamental axioms of mathematics, and working towards giving a full proof of the Kepler conjecture formally. And one of the first big successes of that program was this work by Gertrude Bauer and Tobias Nipko of giving a formal proof of the correctness of this graph hypermap generation program. So this is a piece of computer code that has been verified to be without any bugs whatsoever using these formal methods. Tobias Nipko visited me last year at the University of Pittsburgh, and he updated this formal verification software so that it would work with these new applications that we want, in particular this L12 inequality. In doing so, he found a bug in my original code. This is a bug that had been sitting inside the code for a long time, that it was there. So fortunately, the computer ran in such a way that I just happened to get the right results when I was doing the Kepler conjecture. There are about 5,000 planar graphs that come up in that proof, and I just lucked out that the bug didn't get, it didn't get exercised when that program ran, so I got the right answer. But then when I reran it with this L12 classification of graphs, I got a different answer than I should have, and I was off by one graph. And when we compared it with the formal verification project, we found that my initialization, so I was cutting out some of the search space using symmetries, and that symmetry elimination code was incorrectly initialized and causing certain possibly overlooked certain cases, and in fact one graph was missed. But now this has all been formally checked, and there are about 25,000 graphs that come up in this new classification for the L12 inequality. For the second classification problem, it's much, much simpler. The L12 inequality is the difficult inequality, and the second inequality with the contact graphs is the easy part. There are only 8 graphs, so it's 25,000 graphs on one hand and 8 graphs in the other that come up. So I'll be mostly talking about the L12 inequality because that's where the real work goes, and then the other inequality is sort of the same stuff but much, much easier. I do some pre-processing of the counter. So we assume that we have some counterexample to this L12 inequality. Then we do some pre-processing using compactness to make it sort of the strongest possible inequality. And then it's actually those things that we classify. So there are 25,000 of these stronger possibilities. So my notation I've put down at the bottom, the script B is for the closed annulus with the usual inner and outer radius. The script L of V is the sum that comes up again and again. In the formal work, we're talking about planar graphs, but I use hypermaps whenever I want to do anything combinatorially. I use what I call a fan whenever I want to do anything geometrically with the graphs. This is basically just a planar graph, but instead of taking these are in three graphs laid out in three dimensions because I'm connecting centers of spheres. And I just take the cone at the origin generated by the edge, and it's easier to work with those cones for technical reasons from the formal point of view. So if you see fan coming up here, you can just think graph, but it's just slightly easier from a technical point of view. So to pre-process, what I do is so this is depending only on the distance to the origin. And so I can move these points around without changing the distance to the origin in such a way that the minimum distance between two points is as large as possible. And then I can repeat that process. I can then say, among all of those where the minimum distance is as large as possible, I can make the second smallest distance as large as possible, and then I just iterate through the packing so that they're all ranked repeatedly using compactness. And I can also, since this is a monotonic function, I can push spheres in radially to make them as close as possible. So with this pre-processing, I can prove then that the cardinality of V has to be 13, 14, or 15. This proof that it's 13, 14, or 15, if you were at my lecture on Wednesday, I gave this proof in the two-dimensional case. I had three cases when I was doing this L estimate. I did the case of 6, which was trivial, the case of 8, which was trivial, and then the case of 7 required some argument. And if I take that proof in 2D that I did for the case 7 and translate it into three dimensions, this is the inequality that you get, that it has to be 13, 14, or 15. You also, by doing this compactness argument, you also get this claim number 4, that every node is surrounded. So I surrounded is related to this rigidity from Moosen's lecture the other day. It means that there are at least three edges coming out of each vertex and that the angles are all less than pi. So it gives that the polygons in the planar graph are all spherically convex. Any questions? The key quantity that I estimate is this function tau, this azimuth angle that I write here. This is just this angle. So I have V is a set of vertices, E is a set of edges, F is a combinatorial face. It's something coming from the hypermap. H is just this quantity here. And K here is the number of edges on the face. and I look at this function tau, depending on the vertex set, the edges, and a particular face, and I can rewrite this L12 inequality into this following form, that if I have a counterexample to this inequality, then that is equivalent to the sum of this function tau over all of the faces of the graph being less than 4 pi minus 20 times the solid angle of a triangle of side length pi over 3. So this is just taking this inequality, and you see when you sum over all faces, then you can turn it into a sum over all vertices, and you just use what the Euler characteristic is, the sum of the L and the sum of the angles equaling pi, and you get this identity instead. So if we get good lower bounds on this, so the point is, if we get good lower bounds on this function tau that show that this inequality cannot hold, then we shall prove the L12 inequality. So this is just, I think I'll go over this quickly. This just, I wanted to show you there are all sorts. So the most technically difficult part of the proof then is to come up with good lower bounds on this function tau for each face, and it's this I call the main estimate, but it's also the most technical part of the proof. Coming up, you want to come up with a lower bound on this function tau. When the face is a triangle, the lower bound is zero. And then you have to estimate, you know, when it's a quadrilateral, pentagon, hexagon, and so forth, what are the lower bounds on this function tau. I have this function, as I this program, as I said, that automatically proves nonlinear inequalities. And so it'd be nice if I could just feed these inequalities into that program to get these lower bounds. The problem is that my automatic inequality prover only works for inequalities in a small number of variables. And by the time I have something like a hexagon, there are just too many degrees of freedom to be able to prove it directly. And so to prove this main L12 estimate, what I have to do is just play around with this function tau and find that it's monotonic in different variables and things. And I have to prove all sorts of technical monotonicity results to slowly deform this thing until it has low dimension. And then once it has low dimension, I can feed it into the inequality prover. The main, if I go back, if you look at what this function is, if I'm just summing the angles on a spherical polygon, I'm essentially getting the area of the spherical area of that polygon. And so this should be thought of as some sort of deformation of the usual solid angle of a spherical polygon. And that intuition is fairly helpful in trying to understand the behavior of this function tau. It's just some nonlinear deformation of that. I can combine those lower bounds of tau into a function d that depends only on the number of edges in the face, and then what you do is you give what you want is a classification result. And so the idea is to list properties. Again, I won't spend a lot of time on these technical properties, but I take all of the things that I can prove about the graph, the hypermap, and make that into a definition. So I take a counterexample. I take all the things that I can prove, all the properties that the counterexample must have. I make that into a definition of what it means to be a tame hypermap. These all need to be purely combinatorial properties, so I need to remove all metric geometry. And once I've made it into a purely combinatorial list, I can then feed it into this hypermap generation program that creates all the possible hypermaps up to isomorphism. So this is what the list looks like. Some of them are fairly technical properties. Some of them, like there are 13, 14, or 15 nodes. That came from this earlier estimate. The hypermap is plane is something you don't. Every edge has two endpoints in an ordinary planar graph, but you know when you're dealing with when you express things purely combinatorially in terms of hypermap, it's not true that each edge automatically is a breaks into two cycles, and so you need to put that in as a separate condition. Connectedness, simplicity, the size of the faces, each face has size at least 3 and at most 6. And then the bounds on the function tau. Tau is an analytic function on the faces, and so that isn't directly a combinatorial property. Instead of saying the function tau has such and such a property, you have to say there exists. You get rid of the function tau and you just replace it with an existential quantifier. There exists numbers tau that have such and such a property, and that gets made into another definition of what it means to be admissible weight assignments. That just means that there exist numbers tau that satisfy certain properties. So we make this big list of possible hypermaps, and then you prove directly that the counterexample has all of these properties, and then the classification program then says that everyone has to be isomorphic to one of these, and that completes the first main part of the proof, the graph generation stage. The second stage is, I said linear programming, but really at heart it's a nonlinear optimization problem that we then have explicit combinatorial structures for each possibility V, and we want to show that this particular inequality holds in each case. This gives us then a nonlinear optimization problem. Here I'm just illustrating that when you have a nonlinear optimization problem, you can actually get results. Well, we do what's called linear relaxation. We have all the nonlinear constraints, and we're doing some maximization. The actual maximum of things below these two curves, F and G, might be this point here. But then when I relax this nonlinear curve to something that's linear, and this nonlinear curve G to something that's linear, I get a strict upper bound on the original nonlinear program. But in some cases, the desired bound might be less than what we get after we linearize, because we throw away information whenever we do the linearization. And so then the idea is to do subdivisions of the domain. And if I, this picture just shows that how if I subdivide the domain into the left side and the right side, and then do linearization on the left side and linearization on the right side, I get better linear programming linearization bounds after subdivision than I do before. And so by repeatedly subdividing the domain and then doing linear relaxations, we get better and better approximations to the original nonlinear bound. The reason we're doing linear relaxations is that linear programming is very fast. Nonlinear optimization is very hard to do. And so we want to replace everything by linear problems rather than nonlinear things. But we need to watch out. Every time we subdivide, of course, we're doubling the number of subproblems. We're starting with 25,000 graphs. If we even do a small number of binary divisions, we can rapidly exhaust our computer resources. So we have to be very intelligent about the way we do the subdivisions on this high-dimensional problem.
So when you have the graph, you first, let's say there's nonlinear constraints that you get from the graph.
Yes.
And can you give an idea of how many of those are there in terms of, the, of each graph? Or how does the input grow?
So these problems tend to be, so just naturally, if this has 15 and 3 coordinates each, it'll be a 45-dimensional problem to start out with. But by the time you introduce all the auxiliary variables, it tends to be about 200 dimensions and a couple of thousand constraints is a typical problem. Yes. Okay, so we would have a small, I don't know exactly how many nonlinear equations we would have, something, probably just a couple of hundred constraints, and then a couple of thousand by the time we do the linearization. So, as part of the formalization project, another thesis was written by Stephen Oboa, who did the formalization of linear programming. And he was able to run typical problems that come up in sphere packings in these times. These are times in minutes. So the time, he's able to do a single linear program in something like about 20 minutes inside the formal proof checker. So he was able to do all the ones that came up in the all of the basic cases that came up in the original Kepler conjecture in about 40 days of computation. I've modified the approach since then, sort of significantly simplifying things. So now I do all of the linear programming using the package GLPK. So this is standard linear programming stuff using ample modeling of the linear programs, and I'm writing my code now. I used to use C++ and Mathematica, and now I generate it all in a language, Objective Camel, a nice functional programming language. This is just a standard linear programming package. It's just using floating point arithmetic for GLPK, but then when it gets fed into the formal verification, exact rational arithmetic is used. Okay, so I'll skip this slide. So I want to say a few things about how subdivision is done. And this is something that's all new. In the original 1998 proof of the Kepler conjecture, this was a big mess, and I had to do a lot of this by hand. And it's been completely streamlined for this L12 inequality. So this is an example of one. So this is one of the 25,000 graphs. And when you do the linear relaxation, you're throwing away information. And each vertex here, each node of this graph is corresponding to some vector in three-dimensional space. And so each triangle is corresponding to a tetrahedron in space, where I've got one point fixed at the origin, and then the three other vertices, and you can look at the output from the linear program and compare that to, so the linear program says, okay, I think these edge lengths are such and such, and I think these angles are such and such. Well, you can look, knowing what it thinks the edges of the tetrahedron are, you can calculate, using nonlinear calculation, what the actual angles are, what the actual angles are, and compare that with the linear programming output of what it thinks the angles are. And those differ from each other because one has thrown away the nonlinear information. And what you do then is you plot all of the actual angles versus the pseudo angles that come out from the linear programming and compare the two. And if these numbers were all exactly the same, that would say that no information is lost when you go to the linear programming. But when you get a discrepancy, that's saying that this nonlinear, that this linear model looks significantly different from the linear model. So when you want to design new inequalities to throw into the linear program, what you want to do is to exploit the nonlinearities of the problem. So you look for where the biggest discrepancies are between the linear model and the nonlinear model, and design new inequalities based on that. So that's what you do. You just look for the biggest discrepancies. And then I wrote, this was the funnest part of the project, is automating all of this. So I did this one picture by hand, but we've got 25,000 graphs. We don't want to do them all by hand. So it's a program that automatically finds the discrepancies between the linear and the nonlinear model. Then it's got heuristics for generating new inequalities, nonlinear inequalities, that exploit those discrepancies. Then that gets thrown into a program that automatically does numerical analysis on those inequalities to see whether they're true or false, or how much of an epsilon we need to add to make those true. Then that automatically generates a formal specification of the inequality that gets shipped off to the formal theorem prover piece, and that's written in terms of exact real arithmetic. And then that gets automatically shipped over, generated to C++ code that does the interval arithmetic verification of the inequality. Then that gets sent back into the linear programming problem to get used in the next round of linear optimization. And this worked really great in practice. I mean, it was fun to write this code, and it did just the right thing. So it just automatically generates the nonlinear inequalities that you need and inserts them into the linear program. And in this way, you're able to rule out all 25,000 graphs just using this uniform approach. It generates, in the end, about 500 inequalities that need to get proved by interval arithmetic. And it generates, it doesn't have to do too much branching. So on average, you just need four linear programs per graph, so about 100,000 linear programs in the end. And so it's fairly efficient in the end. So that's the strategy. This is still at the informal level because it's being shipped off to interval arithmetic verification tools. The last step then is going to be to do this formally. I've got a graduate student, Alexei Soloviev, who succeeded. So I told you about the thesis of Oboa that's able to do linear programs in about 20 minutes inside a formal system. Soloviev has cut that down to 3 seconds per linear program. So now we can do linear programming formally verified almost as fast as we can do it without the formal verification. So that part is very efficient. So that's all I want to say about the 25,000 cases. Now for the 8 cases that remain, I'll just say a word. Yes, the function tau uses the same function tau, but it simplifies because you don't have different heights. It's just a contact graph. Again, you estimate lower bounds, same as before, so I won't go through this. One of the main steps is to prove this graph is biconnected. I won't go through the details of that. You make a new list of combinatorial properties that the graph has to satisfy. There are only 8 in this case. And the linear programming part is completely trivial. I just write down very, very simple properties that the graph has to have, like the angles sum up to 2 pi around each vertex. Each angle of a triangle is fixed because it's a contact graph, so you know exactly what the lengths are. Each angle of a rhombus is between a lower obvious lower and upper bound. Opposite angles of rhombus are equal. And linear programming works. So there are 8 graphs that come up. 2 you want to keep. The 6 you want to get rid of. This works on 5 of the 6. There's one graph that it doesn't work on, and it's this graph. But this graph, you just look at it, and you say, okay, this doesn't exist as a contact graph. Because these edges of the hexagon would all have to be pi over thirds, so the perimeter would have to be 2 pi. If the perimeter is 2 pi, then it would have to be a great circle or a digon, but a hexagon is not a digon, and so it doesn't exist. And so you just look at it and see this other one doesn't exist. And so that rules out the last of the 8th, and that gives the theorem. Okay, thank you very much.